Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program on the economic aspects of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, the prices we pay, the futures we face. My name is Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write regular economics columns for Truthout. Truthout.org is a remarkable independent source of news and commentary every day. I urge you to check them out at truthout.org. We also maintain two websites that we update literally every day with material related to the kinds of analysis you get on these programs. If that interests you, if you'd like to pursue a lead about one or another of our stories, or see a whole array of lectures, classes, video and audio recordings of presentations, media interviews, all of that, please visit either of these two websites 24/7 at absolutely no cost. The first one is rdwolf.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. In addition, both websites offer you two other options. You can communicate to us, that is to me, with questions, comments, criticisms. We read each and every one and use what you send us to help plan and design each program. And the second thing you can do on either website is follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and so on. Just go to the website, click on the icons for those social media, and you can follow what we do on a regular, ongoing basis. Let me turn to the shorter economic updates with which we begin every program. I wanted today to start with a story that I think is typical of what happens in a capitalist economic system when you have the economy dominated by large corporations. Over the last couple of weeks, an issue has come to a head that has been going on, in fact, for years. It turns out that the largest automobile company, General Motors in the United States, began having trouble years ago with one of its cars, and the trouble was roughly the following. It turned out that the ignition in the car was very sensitive and could, even if you just tugged inadvertently at a key ring attached to the key in the ignition, or if your knee might bump the thing, it would turn off. And when it turned off, the entire electrical system of the car shut down. And this became a fatal problem because in a number of accidents, the airbags designed to protect the occupants of the car never inflated because that requires an electrical action to happen, and the electrical system had been shut down by whatever happened to the ignition. GM has known about this for years. The government watchdog over, for safety purposes, over the automobile company knew about it. Emails went back and forth. Meetings were held. But what was not done until a week or two ago was a recall of the automobiles. General Motors has now recalled over 2 million of its automobiles that are subject to this malfunction because we've had a number of people killed. The obvious question, which is becoming more and more explosive, is why did so many years go by? Why did so many people die or become injured rather than have a company take the costly step of recalling cars, costly because they have to fix them at their expense, costly because of all the record keeping and notification, costly because of the damaged reputation? Is it, the logical inference goes, is it because they didn't want to incur those costs that in effect the company and the government somehow together postponed the day of reckoning, costing lives, costing injury, costing suffering on a massive basis? If the government that is supposed to supervise the big corporations can be compromised in that process by huge corporations with enormous resources at their disposal, then there's something fundamentally wrong in this economic system. The second update came to me through work I discovered by Judith Resnick, who is a professor of law at the Yale Law School. She has been drawing people's attention in her work to a growing problem, and that is corporations not wanting to have their legal problems exposed to the public in a court of law. Now, over the last half century, roughly from the middle of the 20th century to today, the courts have expanded the rights of Americans, businesses and individuals alike, to have their day in court with the court proceedings public. If a business offends you, if a business treats you badly or endangers you and you file suit, that kind of lawsuit has to happen in a public courtroom whose proceedings are open to the press and everybody else to see. No secret justice, no justice delivered behind closed doors because of the assumption that if justice is not public, there won't be much justice left. Well, the corporations aren't happy. They want to hide the embarrassments that get them into legal trouble. And so they have taken two kinds of steps, and Judith Resnick is very worried about them as a law professor, and I think I want to make sure we all know about it. The first way this is being compromised is that the courts are now allowing more and more corporations to impose contracts on people that if a dispute arises between you and a company, you have signed away your right to a law court suit that will be aired in public. Instead, for example, typical cell phone contract. You rent a phone or you get a service, you buy a phone, and you want cell phone service. Most Americans do. Well, you have to sign a contract, and in that contract, there are words to the effect that if a dispute arises, you've been improperly billed, that has to be resolved in a private arbitration. That's a deal where you go to an arbitrator and the company goes to an arbitrator, often the company paying the arbitrator, and that gets the decision. That decision is lopsided, can be. It can be very unjust, but whether it is or it isn't, it is not open to the light of day. It can be secret. There is no requirement that the proceedings of these arbitrations be made public. And the second way that corporations are doing this is by trying to arrange with the court in Delaware, the state where most corporations, big ones in America, are registered, because they are very favorable laws in the state of Delaware to corporations. They now want the courts in Delaware to be able to arrange that the parties to a dispute rent the judge. I kid you not. Rent the courtroom, rent the judge, hefty payment for that. But the benefit to the company, it is a private judgment and therefore not open to the press, not public, what the outcome was, what the arguments were, what the evidence was. It's a way of keeping business activity secret. And it is something that worries Professor Resnick at the Yale Law School, and it ought to worry a lot of us. And I want to make it public, because public is one of the few protections the mass of people have to this kind of effort of corporate America to shroud what it does in secrecy, to impose on people arrangements for the arbitration of disputes that are secret and therefore can be much more easily tilted in the favor of those corporations. Third update for today strikes me as very interesting. I wanted to mention that the City Council in Washington, D.C. has passed, overwhelmingly, a bill, an ordinance, that decriminalizes the possession and use of marijuana. Because there's an economic lesson here. Let's go through the simple details. Washington's action means that it, along with 17 other states in the United States, that's 17 out of 50, 17 states have already decriminalized the possession or use of marijuana. It is no longer a crime in those 17 states, and assuming the bill in D.C. is approved by Congress, then that'll be also true in Washington, D.C. Two states, namely Washington and Colorado, have gone further. Not only is the use and possession decriminalized, but so is the sale of marijuana decriminalized. This is interesting because it shows a trend. What's the trend? States across the country, all 50, are in economic crisis. The long-lasting unemployment since 2007, the economy that still hasn't recovered for most people, has crippled the incoming revenue of many, many states, still well below what it was in 2007. These states are desperate for money. They've had to cut all kinds of public services, from school teachers to firefighters to police personnel. They don't want to continue to doing that. The outcry of the people is rising about this. They know that they really ought to go after the wealthy who have avoided paying their share of taxes for a long time, but they're afraid politically to do so. Now enter marijuana. Here's a way for the state to get new sources of tax revenue. It goes to the marijuana users and it says, okay, we're going to liberate the stores of our state in Colorado and Washington to sell marijuana, but we're going to put a hefty tax on it. In other words, a taboo, namely the legal sale of marijuana, is broken because of the fiscal needs of the state. And if it happened in Washington and Colorado, and if they're collecting many millions of dollars in state revenue as a result, which they are, you can be sure that the remaining 50 states are looking hard at decriminalizing and hard at making the sale illegal. And this shouldn't really surprise us, because there's an example of something that happened some years ago, very similar. I'm talking about legalized gambling and legalized lotteries. The old ethics of American Puritanism had made gambling kind of under the table, gambling not quite moral, gambling sinful, etc., etc. And lotteries certainly are gambling. But suddenly, as states needed to raise money, and had exhausted what they could tax from average people, and were afraid politically to tax corporations and the rich, who had the money to pay, who had escaped their fair share through dozens of stratagems that everyone in a position of authority knew all about. How do you resolve that problem? You try to discover new sources. Gambling could be something you could somehow demystify. Gambling could lose its religious aura of sinfulness. Gambling could be made routine and normal and acceptable. From dog tracks to horse tracks to off-track betting, the whole nine yards. You gave the people a chance to do what used to be proscribed, what used to be sinful and outlawed, and in exchange, you got a new tax. In the first case, a tax on poor people, because as every study shows, the overwhelming purchase of lottery tickets is by people in the middle and lower income brackets. And now you tax marijuana users. These are all ways to solve the government's revenue problem when it can't burden the average person more than it already does, and it has no political courage to go after the corporations and the rich where the money sits and where the money ought to come from. It finds new ways to tax average people. An announcement also, this last week or two, that Radio Shack, that quite well-known chain across America, providing electronic equipments of all sorts, is closing, according to them, 1,100 stores. The reason I bring this up is not only to bemoan another loss of jobs across the country, thousands of jobs, but it's also a sign of two things. Not that we need much more evidence about it, but these are markers along the road. First, that the so-called recovery of our economy has bypassed, yet another part of our economy. Recovery that we hear about in the newspapers, not something that Radio Shack knows anything about. For Radio Shack, it's not recovery. It's a crisis that has lasted so long that they see no other option but to close 1,100 stores. And another thing, the kinds of jobs that Radio Shack provided, the kinds of incomes, and the kinds of customers in general that it served, that's the so-called middle class. So the collapse of Radio Shack is also a sign that the declining, evaporating middle class continues to do precisely that. The last short update for today. This has to do with what has been happening to the labor force in the United States. As you know, the government has been proudly announcing the decline in the unemployment rate from the 10% it reached in 2009 to the 6 point whatever it is most recently that the government is so proud of, because that's a decline. Well, it is a decline. The problem is you have to understand what these statistics mean. Here's what unemployment is as it is measured by the government. Basically, the government goes to people and asks them a question. Are you working? If the answer to the person, randomly selected, is yes, I'm working, they're counted as employed. If the person says no, I'm not working, a second question is posed to that same person. Are you looking for a job? If the person says yes, then they're counted as unemployed. So if you have a job, you're employed. If you don't have a job but are looking, you're unemployed. But suppose you answer the second question with, no, I am not looking anymore, I've given up, then the government doesn't count you at all. Here's what this means. If from 1 week to the next, from 1 month to the next, the number of people working is the same, and the number of people not working is the same, but the number of people not working who've decided to give up grows, then unemployment will go down. Why? Because there are fewer people without a job who are looking, because they've given up. So the unemployment rate goes down, but does that mean that we have less of an unemployment problem? No. In fact, our unemployment problem is worse, because we have depressed the unemployed who were looking for a job by not giving them one, not enabling them to find one, because we have three times as many people looking right now as there are job vacancies. Those people quit looking. We have the crazy statistic that unemployment has gone down, but for those of us who know how this is measured, there is no such reason to be happy, because it's actually bad news. So the Economic Policy Institute in Washington did a study. What happened to all those workers who quit the labor force, that is, who stopped looking for jobs once they were unemployed? First, they note there's 5.8 million of them since this crisis restarted. That's an enormous number of people. And here's what they find. A clear majority of them are under 55. Why is that important? Because the conservatives, not wanting to face what a disaster this is, and I mean conservatives in both parties, have tried to suggest, oh yes, these are people leaving the labor force because they decided to retire. This is the baby boomer age, and more people are getting old and they're leaving the labor force. This is not to worry about. So the discovery that the majority of these people are under 55 takes care of that, because those are not people that are in a position to retire. The bottom line is, our falling unemployment is not a sign of quote-unquote economic recovery. That's why Radio Shack joined so many other companies in finding itself in hotter and hotter water. Our falling unemployment is a sign that people have given up looking, and that ought to be an alarm going off, not a cause for the sort of celebration that politicians who should know better engage in. Let me turn next to the second part of our program, which is a major discussion of an issue, typically an issue that your emails to our two websites have indicated you would like me to devote. And the issue I want to deal with today has to do with two subjects. The first one is a report. And this report has to do with billionaires. A number of you, and I guess that's understandable, are fascinated by billionaires. The very idea that there are people in the world who have as a personal wealth holding $1 billion. That's $1,000 million. So for each of your $1 million, if you have $1,000 million, then you become a billionaire. You own $1 billion, it's $1,000 million. It's very important for folks to kind of try to get their heads around what this means. So here we have CNBC on the 4th of March. That's the source of this information. CNBC has done us an interesting service. They've taken a look at the roughly 16 or 1700 billionaires known to exist around the world. 16 or 1700. We have a population of 6 or 7 billion people, and we have 1600 billionaires. So the first thing to understand is an absolutely tiny number of people have trillions, that's what they have together, trillions of dollars of wealth. A recent estimate ran something like this. The 1,600 billionaires have as much wealth as the lower half of the population of the earth. Now, nothing more needs to be said. This is an inequality of wealth that puts to shame the pharaohs of ancient Egypt with their pyramids on the one hand and their slaves on the other. We have globalized under capitalism. The system of the last 300 years has created a global, truly global economic system, the way there never was before, has produced an enormous amount of wealth, more than any other system. Capitalism has certainly done that. That's, in a way, if you like, the good news. But the bad news that has to be put together with that is that capitalism distributes that wealth in an unspeakably unequal way. But the CNBC report is interesting because it breaks it down, the 1600. And I thought you'd be interested to see who the billionaires are, where the billionaires are, so you can get a sense of how the inequality has been organized by capitalism. First, the most rapidly growing place where billionaires are rising up, or billionaires are being formed, is the People's Republic of China. That's right. In the 2014 list of billionaires, China registered a record 152 billionaires, up 25% from last year. Hong Kong, which is arguably part of this, had another 45. So China is the exploding locus of billionaires. China, which remains one of the poorer countries in the world, being also the largest country in the world, is growing very quickly, is exploding as its enterprises, increasingly private capitalist, or many still remaining state enterprises, but organized like a capitalist enterprise with a board of directors of state officials and a mass of workers. In China, it is also growing real fast, but it is replicating the kinds of inequality we have seen capitalism produce everywhere else. Capitalism and inequality seem to be very close partners. Who's the richest person in China? The richest of the billionaires? I thought you might like to be introduced. Wang Jianlin, my apologies for the bad pronunciation, is China's richest person. In the list kept by Forbes magazine, he's number 64. And his net worth is $15 billion. Okay? $15 billion. Here's what makes him rich. He owns 75 department stores, 85 shopping malls, and 51 five-star hotels. Last year, 2013, he purchased the movie theater chain AMC Theaters. You might think about that. He listed it on the New York Stock Exchange last December. To celebrate that, he did what billionaires like to do. He flew in celebrities to help launch an $8 billion mini Hollywood in Qingdao in September in China. Who were the two celebrities that this billionaire flew in? Leonardo DiCaprio and John Travolta. How else do billionaires shape up around the world? The United States still remains the number one country, 468 billionaires. Europe is pretty close. Sorry, my mistake. 492 in the United States, 468 in Europe, and 444 in Asia. So the billionaires are spread around. Most of them are men, but slowly, 58 are women out of 1,600. The richest woman billionaire on earth is Christy Walton. She's the widow of John T. Walton, who was in turn the son of Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart. So the widow of the son of the founder is now the richest woman on earth. Did she acquire this wealth through the dint of her hard work and her creativity? No. She inherited it, which is how most wealthy people become that way. Okay. What's the lesson in all of this? Well, for me, and I would urge you to think about this because it really is important. We have an economic system that expects hard work from most adult working people. And for all kinds of reasons, it gets that. Most people work all their adult lives. They try to use their brains and their muscles to contribute something to society. When younger and having gone to school, they tried to acquire the skills. These are the folks that we speak about as working hard, playing by the rules, trying to live well, to be productive citizens, to raise families. In a just society, since we all in our different ways contribute, you would imagine that there would be a mechanism to secure that the well-being of all of those contributing be, in a sense, the first claim on the wealth that's produced. That some get more than others, there could be dozens of justifications for that. But that some become billionaires, while vast others cannot send their child to school without running up impossible debts, cannot put enough food on the table, do not have a decent retirement after a lifetime of work. A system that is generative of wealth, but distributes it so unequally, is a system whose mechanisms could have and should have been questioned much more for a much longer time. These are numbers and statistics and implications that ought to give everyone pause. The debate over whether or not we can do better than a system that works this way is a debate that's long overdue and a debate whose outcome will surprise very few. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. We have come to the end of the first half of this program. We will now take a short break, and I will be back in a matter of seconds in the hope that you will join me for the second half of Economic Update.
Did you read the Sunday paper about the strong stomach 25 who from an expedition all came back alive? From that hostile country where only the stones survive, on Hakey suburbia, bus to one. Picture taking tourists, the war was half a deal. The natives can't believe it, it all seems so unreal. Just to ask the question, now how does it feel? On Hakey suburbia, bus to ride. Unscheduled stops. Watch them kill the crabgrass, but look out for the cops. Hospitals for flowers, the matron ladies cry. Itchy trigger fingers as our caravan waltz by.
Welcome back to the second half of Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I want to remind you, as we usually do, that we have two websites that we maintain and update daily that are full of all kinds of useful economic analysis of the sort you see and hear on this program. If you're interested, please know that these websites are available to you 24/7 at absolutely no charge. The first one is rdwolf with two Fs, .com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Both websites also provide you with means to communicate to us your thoughts, questions, and criticisms. And likewise, both websites allow you to click on the icons of Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest in order to follow us on social media, which we invite and urge you to do. The second major topic for discussion today, as we always do in the middle part of this program, has to do with a set of questions that many of you have actually sent to me over recent weeks. You would like me to talk a little bit about criticisms of capitalism. When did they start being articulated? Who articulates them? Why are they articulated? And can you summarize those that have become the major criticisms of capitalism? And I appreciate that question because it's usually phrased that you want to see a debate develop and you want to yourself help to develop that debate. So knowing more about the criticisms of capitalism will allow you to help generate and engage with others in such debates. So let's talk about criticisms of capitalism. As you know, capitalism is a particular economic system. There are others. Slavery was a different kind of economic system. Feudalism was a different kind of economic system. So-called primitive tribes lived in different economic systems. Capitalism is the most recent to prevail in the world, and it's been around, depending on how you count, 200 or 300 years as a kind of dominant or becoming dominant economic system, beginning in England, spreading to Western Europe, and from there to the areas Western Europeans settled, like the United States and Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and so on, and then becoming eventually global, which it pretty much is today. So criticisms of capitalism, when did they begin? They began with capitalism itself. Like every other system, when it comes into being, and when it grows in the world, it generates those who love it and celebrate it and applaud it on the one hand, and those who find fault with it, who criticize it on the other. In that way, it's really not different from most other systems in the world. For example, the educational system of, I'll pick a country, Namibia. There are people who celebrate and applaud it, and then there are people who criticize it. Let me give you another example. The global monetary system of currencies that exchange. There are people who think our currency exchange system around the world is efficient and effective and wonderful, and those that are critical, who see in it flaws and weaknesses and negative outcomes. So for capitalism to have had the celebrants and the critics is not to distinguish capitalism from anything else. Slavery had that, feudalism had that, and so on. So there's nothing new, nothing special, and nothing subversive about a criticism. It's part of what any system has ever provoked, those who like it and those who don't. Number two, reasonable people seeking to evaluate any system have long learned that it is necessary to talk to those who like it, to hear what they have to say, why they reach the conclusion to celebrate and applaud it, and by the same token, to talk to the critics, to hear their arguments, and to examine their claims as to why a society could or should change, why a better alternative system would be preferable, etc. So there's nothing untoward, nothing suspicious, nothing inappropriate about capitalism having its positive and negative commentators and having the general public wanting to reach a conclusion, an assessment, an evaluation of the system, being interested in hearing from the celebrants and from the critics. Many times in human history, many times in the history of the United States, it has been understood that we need to have among our teachers, among our politicians, and in the public debates, the critics juxtaposed to the celebrants, to hear both sides in order for the general public to have all the relevant information and arguments so that everyone can reach their own conclusion. But unfortunately, there have been other times when this process was blocked, when this process was broken, when it behooved, for reasons I don't have time to go into, it behooved or it was necessary for one group to try to exclude the other. Sometimes the critics excluded the celebrants. Sometimes the praisers, the admirers of the system, excluded the critics. The loser from that? Everybody. Because if you close out one side of the debate, there is no more debate. And if there is no more debate, you don't listen to the criticisms, and then you can't learn from them. And critics often have much to teach. The way we got improvement in our food system in the United States was when critics pointed out how many folks got sick from our meat, or how many folks got ill from our vegetables, and we set in place the mechanisms to deal with those problems. Critics point out flaws. Critics point out weaknesses. And those have time and again enabled people to see a problem and to fix a problem. Sometimes to keep the system but fix the problem. Sometimes to see that in order to fix the problem, you had to change the system. To shut out a critic is to shoot yourself in the foot, to make a system seem more secure than it is. To silence the critic makes the criticism go underground. It doesn't do away with the flaw. In fact, it perpetuates the flaw that drew the attention of the critic. Sadly, over the last 50 years, in the United States and several other countries, criticism of capitalism was excluded. This was done by demonizing the critic, making the critic not a person who sees a flaw, who sees problems, and who explains why they deserve other people's attention. Instead of that, they were seen as foreign agents or evil intended people, people that you could then shut up, exclude from the schools, exclude from the media, exclude from public discourse. You silence them. This is not an achievement that any society should be proud of. It's an outcome that should worry every reasonable person. We're now not going to hear what's wrong. And what's wrong is then going to fester. It's going to get worse because we're not attending to it. And eventually, it'll be a really big problem. You know, silencing a critic is like saying, I'm not going to go to the doctor for my checkup because I don't want to hear negative news. That is a terrible mistake, above all for you, because what you don't hear from the doctor will still be there, and it will get worse. And then by the time you face it, it may be too late. Getting the critical perspective is part of living a safe and secure life. That's true personally with your health, and it's true for a society. Silencing the critics of capitalism, which has been done in the United States, perhaps worse than anywhere else for a long time, at least for any major advanced industrial country, has not been good for its economic development, as time will show and as it already has. Okay, so if criticism of capitalism is as old as capitalism, what have the various critics had to say? Well, it would take me an entire semester in the university to begin to do justice to this topic, and I have taught such courses in universities in my lifetime. But I don't have that time today. So I am going to focus on that criticism of capitalism that has endured the longest, has grown, has had so many people contribute to it, that it is easy to say this is the most developed, the most worked out, the most sophisticated of the critiques of capitalism. And that is Marxism, a body of ideas started by Karl Marx in the 19th century and developed ever since, so that today there are Marxist critics of capitalism working in every country on earth. They are school teachers, they are trade union folks, they are university professors, journalists, all kinds of people who find the critique of capitalism what has persuaded them and what they then incorporate in their thinking, in their writing, in their speaking, and so on. So let me concentrate on what they have to say in the short time I have, and if you would like me to expand on this in a future program, use our two websites and let us know. Okay, perhaps the single most important point, if you like, of Marx's criticism was that capitalism involves exploitation. Now, that's a word that has been used by many people in many different meanings, so I need to tell you what Marx meant, because his meaning is very particular. And I'm going to use simple English because it conveys the idea perfectly well. Think of yourself as going to look for a job and encountering an employer and having the usual conversation with a prospective employer about whether or not that employer and you will enter into a work relationship. And let's suppose after you discuss what kind of work you'll do and where you'll do it and with what equipment and so on, you get to that nitty-gritty point when the issue is, how much am I going to get paid? And let's, to keep it simple, say you're going to get paid $20 per hour. That is, you're going to come Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, and you're going to work those hours, okay, 40 hours, 5 days, 8 hours a day, and you're going to get paid $20 per hour. You know what I'm now going to tell you, even though Marx was the first one to put it in the straight-out way I'm now explaining it. You know that your employer will never hire you for $20 an hour unless the following is true. During that hour that you work, you're going to produce more in value for that employer whatever the goods or services that you help to produce, you're going to produce more of them that the employer takes and sells than $20 worth. Because if you didn't, it wouldn't make sense for the employer to hire you at $20 an hour. Suppose what you added to what he has to sell by your hour's work is worth $20. Well, then he'd sell that, get the $20, use it to pay you, and what's left for him? Nothing. But he's not in business for earning nothing. He's in business to make money, to earn profits. What are the profits? What does it mean to make money? The answer, Marx says, is exploitation, by which he means you as a worker will only be hired if what you produce for the employer, the value you add to what the employer has to sell, is greater than the value of what the employer pays you. So in my example, in every hour that you work, let's say you add $25 worth of stuff for the employer to sell. So you produce in an hour that stuff. He sells it for $25. He uses $20 to pay you what he agreed, and he keeps the other $5 for himself. That's his profit. Then Marx says what that means is, in every hour of your labor, you produce more with your brains and muscles than you get. When you produce more than you get, and the extra, what you produce over and above what you get back, that extra, which Marx, by the way, calls the surplus, when you produce a surplus that another person gets, then in Marx's language, you are being exploited. That's what exploitation means. When working people produce a surplus, that is more than they get, and that surplus becomes the property instantaneously of somebody else. In your workplace, every hour that you work, you produce a surplus. Your employer gets it. It's his automatically as fast as you produce it. It's not yours. It's his. And in that act of exploitation, Marx says much of the capitalist system flows from that. I'll give you just a couple of examples. Number one, a tension exists because no matter how you mask all of this, the basic reality sooner or later becomes clear both to the employer and the employee. The employee develops a sense of being ripped off, a sense that his or her brains and muscles are making profits for somebody else, but not for themselves. The sense that I wouldn't work for anybody unless I get paid what I'm worth has to be falling away as it dawns on you that you're only getting a job because you produce more than you get. If what you're worth is what you can produce, you never get paid that. And that rankles, and that bothers you. And to make a long story short, this situation induces a tension, a conflict, trouble right in the core of production. A tension, a distrust between employer and employee that no amount of Muzak and no amount of lovely speeches by the employer ever can erase. It's a way of organizing production that puts conflict at its core, and that's never efficient. And Marx elaborates that. The second argument Marx makes about how exploitation matters has to do with this. The employer takes the profit and gives as much of it to himself as he can. He takes some of it to pay the costs of business, to buy more equipment and all of that, but he gives himself as much of it as he can. And when he does that, the gap between rich and poor widens. Workers are always given as little as the employer can get away with giving them. Why? Because the less you give to your worker, the more surplus you get for yourself. That conflict between them, it always means squeeze the worker maximize the profit. But to the extent that you do that, you're widening the gap between yourself, the employer class that gets richer, and the mass of workers, something we've already looked at in this program, as we do in many of our programs. The evidence of that is overwhelming. So Marx's argument is the tensions and conflicts of the workplace and the inequality of capitalism, they all are qualities that emerge out of the basic exploitative nature. Well, let me turn, and I can see that we're going to use a bit more time than I had anticipated, so we'll hold the question over till next week. Let me turn to this second big kind of criticism of capitalism that Marxists, but also non-Marxists, have long understood. Capitalism, wherever it has arrived, from England in the beginning all the way across to every other part of the world, wherever it has arrived, it has been fundamentally unstable. What do I mean? Well, the terms of this are crisis. Some people like to call it business cycle. What I mean is instability in the sense that periods of prosperity and upswing are followed by depression, and so on. That our economic system of capitalism bounces around like a rubber ball, except it's a tragic bounce because whenever it goes down, millions of people are thrown out of work. Millions of dollars of goods and services are never produced, poverty is worsened, etc., etc. And capitalism has been this way since its beginning. Countless leaders have said, we're going to do something about this, but they never have succeeded. That's why we're in one of the worst economic downturns in capitalism's history for the last 6 years. We have not solved that problem. Capitalism's intrinsic instability is an unsolved problem. Whatever the benefits of this system, it brings us instability. And you know, as Marx liked to point out, if you keep throwing millions of people out of work every 3 to 6 years, and we have cycles pretty much every 3 to 6 years, many of those people are never going to come back to work. It's too much of a trauma to get your hopes up, to start working real hard, to save a little money, and boom, you're thrown out of work. That happens to you 2 or 3 times. You give up. You're too psychologically stressed and damaged. It's not an efficient arrangement. Meanwhile, during those downturns, millions of people are without work, and the society doesn't get the benefit of their creativity and their labor. Goods and services are sitting idle because the people aren't working. That's crazy and irrational. If we don't need all those people working, then everybody should have less hours of work a week rather than a few people be completely destroyed by unemployment while everybody else works as hard as before. That's not rational. Now, Marx takes this instability and he says, look, this is a fundamental inefficiency of capitalism. And here he's ironic and humorous in some of his writings when he points out the strangeness of capitalism. The particular enterprise tries very hard to be as efficient as possible in making fountain pens or in making shirts or in making software programs. Very efficient in the factory to minimize all waste. Meanwhile, in the economy as a whole, we have millions of people without work. We have, for example, in the United States today, according to the Federal Reserve, 20% of our tools, equipment, and raw materials are sitting idle, gathering rust and dust, no good to anybody. This is a system of colossal inefficiency. The wasted output of those people, the suffering of their families, the loss of their work skills, the loss of their connections to the working process altogether, their sense of alienation from their fellow citizens, the resentment of fellow citizens of the social welfare given to them so they literally don't starve to death. All of these social conflicts and traumas and costs because the system is so unstable. This is an inefficient economic system. The efficiency inside the enterprise is offset by the inefficiency of the larger macroeconomic situation with its periodic plunging of people into unemployment and production to collapse. So Marx says, let's start there. And I will end today by saying, let's think about capitalism as having critics who have figured out that the exploitation at the heart of production and the instability that characterizes every capitalist system are fundamental flaws. Now, from that point of criticism, a debate should emerge. And the debate is, A, can we fix these problems while preserving capitalism, assuming for the moment that that's a reasonable objective? Or, the debate could go, is it such that these problems are so basic, so intrinsic to capitalism, that the only way to overcome exploitation and the only way to overcome instability is to change the system? Well, Keynes, the famous Keynes from England, and Keynesian economics is an effort to fix the system while preserving capitalism. Keynes was a critic of capitalism, but only to the point that these problems, and he was particularly concerned with instability, didn't care much about exploitation. We can fix it, he said. Modern monetary and fiscal policy can and will fix it. The Marxists take a different position. No, Keynes, you didn't fix it. That's why we're in a crisis today. The system is intrinsically unstable and intrinsically exploitative, and the solution is to go to a new and different system. We can do better than capitalism, and we ought to. I will come back to revisit the debate among Marxian, Keynesian, and mainstream defenders of capitalism in future programs. Thank you very much for being with me. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Gonna be my time, babe. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.